So what I'd like to discuss today is a topic that has been raised before at this workshop, maybe not quite in the same way that I will discuss it here, which is the question of the paramagnetic quantum critical point, that is, specifically, the nature of temperature, pressure, phase diagram on a system of order of thermological metals. I think it's one of the key points that was not evident or not present in the original model of the problem developed in the 70s, essentially in all the cases where we have been able to explore the thermodynamic critical point quite carefully, we find that the temperature-pressure phase diagram is characterized by a tricritical point, which means that there is a line of second-order ferromagnetic transition. And we normally think of ferromagnetic transition being secondary. This line reaches its critical point and goes into a sheet, a first-order phase transition at the last moment. So it looks like the quantum critical point of dual theory is never really reached in any material. However, this does not mean the problem is somewhat interesting. As we'll see, there are some surprises involved in this type of phase transition. So I'd like to begin by going back to the early days to the problem of what model that started to some extent to deal with quantum criticality, starting from the thermodynamical theory of the 60s and going on to the self-consistent thermodynamic theory, the self-consistent spin fluctuation theory developed in the 70s and 80s. And this is now being called the attenuant scenario, or maybe you could call it the attenuant electron model specifically. So it's characterized by one, the dynamics that's come out of the thermodynamic theory, the dynamics that is present in RTA theory or in thermodynamic theory, and also a functional, which is analogous to the Ginter-Landau-Wilson functional, which is fourth order in the transformation. And in fourth order term is treated as a mean field approximation. That defines what is called the attenuant scenario. And what is being plotted here for definiteness is that these are the expected result for the case of nickel aluminum, which is a crystallizing or cubic copper three gold structure, and has the Curie temperature and low temperature or ordered magnetic moment about one order of magnitude lower than that of pure nickel. So if we were to look at nickel on this kind of phase diagram, would be a sort of negative pressure here of about one to one. So by diluting the nickel with aluminum, we have gone over to a system close to the quantum critical point, where this point can be reached with less than 100
kilos. Yeah, could you put it in?
So let me repeat. This is then the predicted phase temperature pressure phase diagram for nickel to aluminum, which is a diluted form of nickel, one may think, that is very close to the critical pressure. And in fact, critical pressure has been found recently to be about 80 kilobars. For nickel, it would be about 1,000 kilobars. What's plotted here is the Curie temperature, which in this model goes as 1 minus P over PC to the 3/4 power. And also, there's two crossover lines shown here in blue or purple. This one is a crossover from a low temperature Fermi liquid state, where the resistivity is quadratic in temperature, as predicted by this model. And this one is a crossover from a resistivity of approximately 5 T to the 5 form, T to the 5 thirds form, where the exponent is 5 thirds, into a state where the exponent gradually goes over to linear and then saturates at very high temperature. These exponents, 5 thirds and 3 quarters, depend only in the model on the dimensionality of phase and on the dynamical exponent. The dimensionality of phase for this cubic structure is taken to be 3, And the dynamical exponent is defined by the central quantity in this type of theory, which is the relaxation rate as a function of wave vector for the term out of bounds, for the long wavelength fluctuation. This linear term here is arising from the liquid theory and is going back to do the lambda damping. And these are corrections which arise in an RPA type theory. Kappa is the magnetic correlation wave vector, 1 over the magnetic correlation length, and it diverges along this red line, along the Curie temperature. So, at least along that line, or when kappa is small, the dynamical exponent is 3, which is equal to the dimension of space, the special case.
Gil, what is the purple line on the right-hand side of the TNFL?
Yes, I'll describe the meaning of it. It's really a continuation of this line. So in this region here, one expects T to the 5/3 exponent. This is a prediction model. The predictions are not based on any free parameter. They're measured. They're based on measured quantity, namely the spin fluctuation relaxation spectrum and the correlation, specificated correlation wave vector. And this energy scale here, theta, which is the measured in nickel to aluminum, is given by that figure. I guess you cannot see everything. So the interesting point in here is, first of all, that the T to the 5/3 strictly applies when kappa is 0. When kappa grows from this point up and increases above the Curie temperature, and so eventually you find that the exponent goes away from 5/3 into something else more linear and then eventually saturates at high temperature. The range of this line, the crossover, is defined by some criteria. For example, with the exponent falling 10% below 5/3. So that if you were to plot data over that range, you would see roughly 5/3 behavior. Remember, these are predictions. One thing that is perhaps less well known is that from the exchange of these spin fluctuations with a cubic dispersion relation, from the emission and absorption processes, one finds that the imaginary part of the electron self-energy, the quasi-particle relaxation rate, is linear in energy measured from the Fermi energy. So this is a form which was introduced in the Cooke rates under the model called the marginal Fermi liquid model. But here, of course, it originates from an entirely different mechanism. So here, in contrast to the Cooke rate, it is long wavelength modes which are generating this effect. And because they are ineffective in reducing the current by phonon, for example, one finds that the resistivity is not linear in temperature, but goes as a power somewhat higher than linear, but still less than 2, the Fermi liquid value. In the case of phonon G, you go from a power 3 to 5 due to the small angle scattering correction factor. And here, similarly, we go from T to the 5/3 for similar reasons. I should say that this result has been known, but it was somewhat buried in the literature. Was carried out, the calculation was done in Belushinsky and Kondratenko in 1976, more or less forgotten, I believe. Then Bayham and Petnick reconsidered a whole class of problems in which the imaginary part of the self-energy is linear in energy. This is in their books on Fermi liquid theory chapter. And there they point out that this is one example of a whole class of examples of marginal Fermi liquid. So sometimes it is objected that one calls this a marginal Fermi liquid state because it's so different from the Cooke rate, but there is also a similarity. So we mean it in the sense that the self-energy has this form. Now, of course, this is in a way the starting point for thinking about the quantum critical point. We don't expect it necessarily to be correct, but maybe in some cases, but not in general. I want to show, first of all, a few cases, or one case, where it does seem to work pretty well. Yeah.
Maybe it's just a simple question. I used to think that if we are right at the critical pressure and we turn temperature up, there should be some region of 5/3 behavior.
Yeah, I know.
You are showing that the lines are...
I agree. It's surprising, this result. But actually, it turns out that it is really look like this. If you do a numerical calculation of this model, there is, of course, essentially an infinite number of decades below this point where you will see T to the 5/3. Mm-hmm. And that then is still an infinite range.
Oh, it actually comes to a halt before it hits the...
Oh yeah, this is a finite temperature here.
I see. Uh-huh.
It's not zero.
Uh-huh.
By the way, what really surprised me when we did this is that it comes down to such a low temperature compared with the energy scale in the problem, which is 4 to 6,000 Kelvin for DNA. This is a rather surprising result, right? But we checked in many different ways and you can't escape this. So in fact, there's a very narrow range for this heat of the factor at the critical pressure. And there's actually a much better chance of seeing it out here. So we've spent a lot of time looking for it in this region with some difficulty because, in fact, the transition at the last moment is first order. But actually, we can see something like a first order behavior out here. And that's what I want to show you now.
Can you also remind us what causes that change from linear temperature to T to the 5/3 and then down to the thermal liquid? There must be two criteria because if two cross over. One you mentioned is the correlation length is kind of setting a scale. What is the other?
Okay, well, the criteria are tied up with this. There are two wave vector scales that are important. One is kappa, which is a correlation wave vector. The other is the typical thermal wave vector, which is obtained by setting gamma equal to the temperature. And so in contrast to the theories of critical phenomena below the upper critical dimension, where you basically have one space scale, one feedback scale, the correlation wave vector, here we have two to contend with that are very important. And in fact, it's the interplay between those two wave vectors that determine the crossovers, and we'll go over in mathematical detail afterwards.
You're saying that interplay determines even larger crossover? Because I would understand that interplay determines the lowest crossover between Fermi liquid and 5/3 behavior. But are you saying that the upper crossover...
But it also determines this because we need to keep the temperature dependence in here. And then this temperature dependent quantity becomes important relative to, which grows at a different rate in temperature from this thermal vector. You get it. That's my concept.
So basically everything depends on what the temperature dependence on, of course.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. And then we had to actually obtain these graphs in two ways. One through this more intuitive argument that we're just using, and through numerical analysis, to get the same curve. Well, I wanted to use this because normally one has graphs like this, which are generic, and I wanted to show what it looks like in a specific case, and some surprising feature actually about it. Now, this type of theory has been reviewed critically in recent times, and there are a number of possible objections to it, but it does, in some cases, seem to work pretty well, though, as you'll see, there are also difficulties with it.
Well, what happens at the critical pressure above that point where you go from the marginal
thermal
liquid to something else? What is that above
there? It goes gradually to linear. So if you plot the exponent, say by plotting the logarithmic derivative of the resistivity, you see a gradual transformation from 5/3 to linear to zero.
That
saturates. The resistance is saturated for 5/3.
But below that cusp, you're going to have then T squared.
Yeah. Again, it's all continuous.
T to 5/3.
Well, you have squared as well. So let's go back.
Yeah, it's in the Fermi liquid region.
There is a Fermi liquid region down here, and you see it's below 2 Kelvin.
And it vanishes after
this is then the 5/3 region. Then linear going to 0 power is the result. And the most precise way of describing this should be something like the logarithmic derivative, which shows a continuous variation. Then we can set criteria for dividing up the temperature scale, as I've done here, to make a comparison with generic plots one often uses in this field.
That linear means that small angle scattering no longer matters?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're getting up to the cutoff. There's a cutoff in the problem, which is the Brillouin zone. And of course, this simple form does not necessarily extend up to this cutoff, so it's like a Debye approximation. However, it turns out in MNSI, this form extends all the way up to the zone boundary. It's remarkable. This is a good fit to the neutron scattering spectrum. Basically, the line width of the inelastic neutron scattering gives you the relaxation rate. Now, let's show where there is some correspondence between this type of modeling experiment, and then also and show you where things go wrong. So what I've plotted here, the resistivity, an experimentally measured resistivity, measured from the zero temperature value, rho zero, normalized 100 Kelvin Hunting Calvin assures it becomes the pronoun contribution appears to be very small below that and starts to become important around 200 Calvin to 300 Calvin. This is just to normalize the divisivity. The plotted versus t to the 5/3, I'm afraid you cannot quite see the numbers here. In two cases with different curing temperatures, one tuned by doping, that is changing the concentration of nickel and aluminum, and the other by the application of pressure. And here we have the calculation of the resistivity using the same normalization procedure versus the absolute of the temperature to the 5/3 power. And what goes into this model is in essence the energy scale of these spin fluctuations and kappa squared, which in itself either measured or can actually be computed self-consistently within this type of theory. There's no adjustment going on in comparing these two sets of plots. The input parameters are not free for adjustment plots. And one sees some correspondence, and in particular, for example, the actual transition temperatures come out within a few degrees. And in fact, in all the cases that we consider, and the crossover to something fairly linear in pieces of 5/3. Remember, it's not going to be precisely linear because kappa squared varies the temperature. But the forms are quite similar, except at low temperatures here, where there's a behavior that gets more extreme as one approaches the critical pressure, which is about 80 kilobars. And this is a more complete study published in this paper here, going all the way up to the critical pressure. And one finds that there is a behavior in this region where we might have expected the simplest type of behavior, a behavior that was not described in this model at all. But this is really only the tip of the iceberg of what I want to discuss.
Again, the cusp is that G mayor in the theory?
This is actually...
Discontinuity in the gradient, the cusp is that G mayor?
That's the theory temperature, yeah.
There's only gypsy chips. So.
Yeah. It's also obtained by acceptability data, which is much more sharply defined, of course.
The low temperature region, below the Curie temperature, it's T squared or T to the 5/3?
No, the T squared, you see, is not even visible on the scale.
So it's T to the 5/3.
Even in the model, it's predicted to arise only below a couple of Kelvin. It's not visible on the scale. Though below 1 Kelvin, we do see T squared.
You are seeing the quantum critical regime already way below the transition temperature.
Yeah, you see, actually, I should point out, although we're 80 kilobars away from the critical pressure, this is behaving as a critical system the whole way. Mm-hmm. And the V metal and 80 kilobars corresponds to the equivalent of a couple of kilobars in every
term. But above the Curie temperature, it becomes linear in temperature in the experiment?
Oh, way above. If you go way above this temperature, eventually you see a linear variation in the theory. So I've only really gone up to a temperature where you see a 5/3 behavior, roughly. But the point is about this is that the comparison between the experiment and the theory is on absolute scales, and not only is there a reasonable qualitative similarity, but also quantitative similarity in the result. So this suggests that there's something. The energy scales that are being introduced in the problem are of the right order of magnitude. The basic physics might be close to the correct physics for describing the problem, but then there are difficulties that now I want to discuss. By the way, this is only an example. There are many, many demonstrations of the applicability of this type of model in the magnetic equation of state, in other materials besides what you see here, lattice expansion, the heat capacity, the field dependence of these properties. Can be understood reasonably well using this model. And many of these are points that are brought out in Maria's book in 1985.
And this change of slope of the t to the 5/3 can be associated with like a change of the band structure because of
the change of the slope of the t to the 5/3, that what you
talking? Yeah, it looks like it's two straight lines above and below Curie temperature.
Oh, well, of course, let me say that in the model, the temperature dependency in the low, in this region, the low PC is rather complicated. It turns out to look more or less close to 5/3, but it's only close to and above TC, that you count the square to zero and you would expect the five-thirds behavior. So you can see, if you look very carefully, that yes, it looks like five-thirds in this region here, but it's not. It's a numerical result. It wasn't obvious to us that it would come out to be five-thirds.
The top left panel is the actual experiment.
Oh, these are experimental results here.
It looks like pretty good, a straight line.
And these are calculations. They are, yes. And I suppose the answer to that is that kappa squared is quite small over the whole range. And it does change with TC. There's a different temperature than the kappa squared below and above TC.
It's great to see a theta five.
Do what?
It's great to see the theta five.
Well, the question is whether this is sufficient to establish the model. But I think it isn't on its own. But if one looks at many other problems, one finds similar kinds of correspondence between the theory and the experiment. But I wanted to discuss here the difficulties rather than the successes of the model set. So it would be interesting to just go over, for the record, the many cases where the subject model does get sensible results. But I wasn't planning to be okay. So I wanted to discuss what can go wrong. the first point is that in the naive picture, the exchange of paramagnons between a current carrier, so the spin fluctuation, can lead to an interaction, which can be attractive for certain spin orientations. And that then may lead to a particle instability. And in the simplest model, one expects B wave pairing on the border of anti-ferromagnetism and C wave pairing on the border of ferromagnetism. However, if you make even fairly modest changes in the model that you begin with, you get phase diagrams that are quite different from the one that I'm showing you here. This is just purely for illustration. And one might also expect the long-range interactions that are mediated by these fluctuations, in some cases, to produce really particle hole instabilities, which are anisotropic, which means finite angular momentum, for example, from a Lorentz instability. I'm not aware of the observation of these effects, at least not in zero field. Another difficulty that arises is that very close to the magnetic critical point, and having had a number of heavy fermion systems, one also finds a density transition, which is a symmetry conserving volume transition of the lattice, known as the alpha gamma transition. And in cases where this is a non-symmetry breaking transition, so it tends to be first order with a critical endpoint. And when the critical endpoint lies quite low in temperature, the exchange of these density fluctuations can also mediate supersonitivity in a similar manner. And we'll see an example of this in a moment. And finally, the third category of difficulties that I wanted to discuss is that if you expand, forget about supersonitivity for a moment, and expand this region close to the ferromagnetic boundary, and then maybe similar things happen on the border of anti-ferromagnetism. But that, I don't think that problem is carefully studied, as carefully studied. I will just refer to the ferromagnetic boundary. One finds that the phase diagram looks more like this in the lower portion of the slide, where the magnetic field is now included and goes into the page. What one sees is a second order phase transition going into a tricritical point, followed by a plane of first order phase transition, which extends now in magnetic field and pressure. So if we fix magnetic field, for instance, we get a line of first order transition going up to a critical end point, which is very analogous to this line here in Flanders. And because, again, there's no symmetry breaking in the actual ferromagnetic state, so these are metamagnetic transitions. So this is a line of critical endpoint here, which extends to zero eventually at sufficiently high magnetic field. So what has happened is that in the starting picture, we have a second order phase transition going to zero at this point. In the picture we now have, something still goes to zero. The second order transition goes to zero, but not along the pressure axis, but at some point which involves both pressure and magnetic field. And there are now probably of the order of 10 systems that we can say can be described approximately by this type of system. Well, first sight, of course, this looks, well, okay, so we've just changed the problem, now we must look for some interesting phenomena here. Of course, if the field is high enough, this precludes the possibility of superconductivity, but might actually open up the possibility for the Pomerantz type of instability, or other type of instability. And so it's interesting in its own right. Another point of interest is that, at first, I think most of us thought that if you go across this boundary, because the transition is first order, kappa is finite everywhere along this axis of low temperature. And so we essentially go from a thermoliquid state to another thermoliquid state, from a thin polarized thermoliquid with T squared resistivity to another one with T squared resistivity and some somewhat different coefficient on the right hand side on the paramagnetic side. And the first thing I want to say is that this type of phase diagram is not inconsistent with the model I discussed and called the attenuated electron model. If we merely change the sign of the quartic term in the phenomenology, and all of this is a phenomenology, if we change the vertical sign of the quartic term in the Ginsburg-Lambda-Wilson functional and introduce a six-order term to stabilize the problem, and a model like that will in fact give you this type of phase diagram. However, what it predicts is T squared going to T squared tremendously in several interesting cases where this critical endpoint is quite low in temperature. You find over the same temperature range, not T squared, but a curious feature which we have. And that, no one has been able to show that that can come out of the attenuated model that I discussed earlier. And that is really a contradiction with the theory.
When you say several, I mean, we all know MNSI,
yeah.
I think that
way. Yeah, there are others now.
Yeah. Can you comment?
Cobalt disulfide, which is just in the process of being finished, is another case where we see this behavior. And that does not have a spiral structure,
yeah,
so as you know.
Close
enough. I'll make a list later of other systems that, yes, where this is actually seen. Let me, before discussing this problem, giving you the list of the other examples, let me just review what examples or illustrate examples of that type of behavior transitions of a superconducting instability. And my first examples are an antiferromagnetic material, and then finally an example of the ferromagnetic type. So in this material, cerium, palladium, to silicon tube, one finds that the anneal temperature vanishes at around 28 kilobars, and around the vanishing point, there exists a narrow dome of superconductivity, and which has now been established to be bulk phenomena by heat capacity measurements at high pressure. The measurements and heat capacity measurements were made recently in Dresden, Geneva, and Bologna. But we also find in cerium, nickel, to germanium, to a second dome. The first one is thought to be due to the proximity to an antiferromagnetic critical point here, zero pressure. And the second one was, at first sight, was unexpected and a bit of a mystery. And Malthe-Gloesch investigated this problem in some detail and thought perhaps this was a clue, some kind of clue, as to why cerium copper to silicon tube seemed to have a very wide superconducting dome far above the critical pressure for antiferromagnetism, which in this field had been a long-standing mystery. In fact, historically, it led to the belief that magnetism was the enemy of superconductivity, that superconductivity seemed to disappear as we approached the magnetic boundary, whereas the other point of view that I suggested earlier, that the exchange of spin fluctuation leads to the fact that magnetism is actually the friend and can actually generate superconductivity close to the boundary of magnetism. Now, this problem was pursued at Dresden in Frank Segre's group, and Grosch and his student Juan and other co-workers have recently shown that in fact cerium copper to silicon tube also has a double dome structure. When it is doped with germanium slightly, one finds a superconducting dome, and this is really their result published 2 years ago, supervening dome around the anticholinergic critical point, followed by a second and well-separated supraconducting dome around a point which they believe is an alpha-gamma transition or a volume change transition. And the volume changes have been observed in X-ray measurements across, going along this pressure axis here. And interestingly, the critical endpoint for this type of transition is very low in temperature, maybe below 20 K. This allows for the density function to be quite strong and to potentially mediate themselves the superconducting instability. And as these authors here have shown, this both of these kinds of instability can have D-wave symmetry. Now, when you go from the built germanium samples to the pure cerium copper to silicon tube, the two domes coalesce and give you one wide region of superconductivity, which had, in the early days, given people the impression that somehow magnetism was actually injuring or destroying superconductivity, which is only part of the story.
But, so far within this picture, this red region and green region are due to different fluctuations.
Yes.
And nevertheless, they collapse and produce your...
However, this interesting point is that they produce the same symmetry state, D-wave state.
Mm-hmm.
And that means, in a sense, they're glued, two types of glues generating the same superconducting state. It's not inconceivable that the two could happen at the same time. And by the way, I want to point out that in them, there have been similar proposals in the Kupre, the density fluctuation producing superconductivity, the Kalski model, and which is also D-wave, and magnetic fluctuation producing providing another mechanism for superconductivity, which gives the same symmetry state, same D-wave state. Now, another interesting development mentioned by Pierce earlier was that if we consider the effect of lattice anisotropy in going from cubic cerium indium 3, which is antichrominetic with an antichrominetic transition temperature shown in this blue curve here, which has a superconducting dome as found in the cerium relating to silicon tube at very, very low temperature. If we now go from this cubic structure to a tetragonal structure, which was achieved by introducing rhodium indium plane by Zach Fisk and his co-workers, one then finds a sort of a wider separation of the cerium plane and a much higher superconducting transition, and in fact, the superconducting dome that emerges is now about an order of magnitude, and this is already magnified by a factor of 3 here, about an order of magnitude higher in temperature and wider in pressure. It's a very strong lattice superconducting state. And in fact, the temperature over the characteristic phase fluctuation temperature is now quite a small number. So in a sense, this is a high temperature superconductor in that in relation to the energy scales in the problem. Now, of course, it's tempting to think that the most important change is the transformation from a cubic to a tetragonal structure, but other things are happening as well. And so one cannot be sure what is in the end, why this is happening. But I want to point out that this was anticipated to some extent by a closer examination of the magnetic interaction model, which is this single exchange of spin fluctuations. This has a very long history, dating back to helium 3, the P-wave prediction, P-wave superconductivity in permanent metals in the 70s and 80s, and then the extension of this theory to D-wave systems in the 80s by a number of people, and notably by Dr. Salatino. There are many, many works, and it's impossible for me to give a proper list of references. One I wanted to just point out is that recently, Philippe Montou and I have re-examined, for the purposes of guiding experiment, re-examined the predictions of this model to see where one should look to test it more completely. There's also been a re-examination of the so-called breakdown of Vidgo's theorem, which has been known since the early 70s, that this type of single spin fluctuation exchange picture is not like the single phonon exchange in the case of conventional superconductivity, and that there is no actual magnetism with k. However, what Philippe has found is that provided that one is not too close to the magnetic boundary, the vertex corrections do not alter qualitatively the behavior. And so for the picture that I want to, for the kind of results of the calculation for a specific set of parameters shown here, one has the transition temperature normalized to the energy scale in the problem, which is related to the bandwidth, versus the magnetic correlation wave vector square, so kappa equals zero indicates the border of magnetic order. And we have here several different cases of systems on the border of antichromaticism, ferromagnetism in blue, and in quasi-2D structure and quasi-3D structure, they're all compared. Given that the only changes that occur in the case of, for example, ferromagnetism, the antichromaticism, the Q vector at the peak in the susceptibility shifted from 0 to pi pi. And in going from 2D to 3D again, the only change is the lattice itself, or the anisotropy of the lattice. Now, what we have shown is that this type of calculation becomes progressively poorer and poorer as approximation as one goes to kappa equals 0. But there is a region of where one has more or less a Fermi liquid state, where the model may have some maybe of some use. And notice that in particular it predicts that as we go, for say, the border of antichromaticism from 2D to 3D, the transition temperature can decrease rather dramatically. And this conceivably, or at least is part of the reason why the study was carried out, to look for the effect of anisotropy. And these are extreme limits of 2D and 3D. If you go continuously by elongating the structure continuously from cubic structure to two-dimensional structure, you find a continuous variation. It's not a sudden change that occurs from this curve to this curve, but a continuous variation. Another interesting prediction of this model is between the ferromagnetic and antichromagnetic critical points. So the red lines are for the antichromagnetic case, the blue for the ferromagnetic. And we see that in going, for example, from the 2D antichromagnetic to the 2D ferromagnetic, we see again a very dramatic drop in Pc. So the superconductivity in the border of ferromagnetism is much less likely to be observed if this model is correct. And indeed, it has taken many years to find any example of superconductivity in the border from magnetism. I might just point out that the research started in the early 70s, soon after the discovery of helium, liquid helium, superfluidity of liquid helium 3. And the argument went something like this, that the energy scales in the early ferromagnetic metal would be in the D metal about 1,000 times higher than in helium 3, which is the difference in the bandwidth. And that therefore, one would expect transition temperatures of order 1K in metals on the border of ferromagnetism. This was looked for in many metals, many nearly ferromagnetic metals, and no signs of superconductivity had been found. This is perhaps part of the answer, and if we try to understand what makes a difference by analyzing the model, it turns out there are a couple of points. First is that in the triplet pairing state, the transverse spin fluctuations are pair breaking in the sense that they produce master normalization that do not contribute to the pairing parameter in, for example, the Macmillan type formula. They affect the numerator, in fact, they do not contribute to the denominator. This reduces Pc in the exponent. And put it differently, spin triplet pairing depends only on the longitudinal fluctuations, which are polarized in the same direction of the spin. That is one of the factors. But it turns out there's another more subtle phenomena that occurs that I want to discuss. And I think this additional effect is the real killer, in my opinion, as to why it has been so difficult to find superconductivity in the border of ferromagnetism. And it's a point I wish to make in relation to strong from ruthenate, which is shown here, the Fermi surface is shown here for the three bands that characterize this material, the T, to E to G bound, which is the X, VXY, which gives the Fermi surface in yellow, and then the other two bounds, the XZ, YZ, which are not as important for superconductivity as it is thought. Superconductivity in the theory of Rice and co-workers, it primarily arises in this yellow XY band. Now let's look at the Linhart function for this XY band, which is actually calculated starting from the Fermi surface fitted to the Dyson alpha data. So the Fermi surface of the XY band is shown here, nearly touching the zone boundary, very close to Van Hill singularity. And that although the Fermi surface looks virtually circular and is very simple, the Linhart function is anything but simple. And if we were to sort of think about, say, helium-3, we would imagine having, in the simplest model, a peak around the origin for the Linhart function, which is used to construct chi q omega, which is the input to the theory for magnetic current. Instead of a single peak falling off from the origin, we have two groups of peaks. One group here displaced from the origin somewhat and arises from nesting, which can only be seen in the lattice structure by the extended zone scheme, by translating the Fermi surface to touch the neighboring Fermi surface in the extended zone scheme. And then there is a set of high Q peaks which come from a different translation shown here. Now, both of these are actually pair breaking in the p-wave channel. And another point to make, and I'll come to that in a little bit more in a moment, another point to make is that this type of, so if we enhance this with a molecular field, there's a greatly enhanced peak, but this would suggest that as we enhance this system more and more, instead of going into a thermodynamic state, it may actually go into a spiral state, which is just dictated by these peaks here. In fact, this is not necessarily restricted to this problem because it's a generic problem of being close to a Van Hoogh singularity. If we think of ferromagnetism as arising from a high-density state because the system is close to a Van Hoogh singularity, then we're really going to be faced with two problems. First of all, the density of states is concave up, and this changes the sign of the fourth-order term in the Dinker-Lambda-Wilson field theory to a negative number, which means we're forced to include a sixth-order term. And we're more or less automatically going to get the phase diagram where it's shown you up before. But if there's more to this, it would seem that it may be difficult to even get ferromagnetism, and that we're always going to make commensurate ferromagnetic phase, with therefore spiral as being the norm.
But wouldn't you get the phase diagram you showed, you would get a closed order transition everywhere? And why would I ever get the second order transition?
That's because in that model that I described earlier, we see a transition from first order low temperature to second order high temperature because there's a mode coupling correction to the quartic coefficient, starts out negative but then crosses zero. So I mean, plot it this way. Say, let's say we call the fourth order term B in the Gabor-Lambda functional. Now then we may have another parameter here, m to the sixth. Now, in the mean field theory, this term here renormalizes this function of temperature and will give you a result that looks like this, the function of temperature, and this is B of T. So this is the corrections with B, the zero temperature value, B, the function of temperature, which goes in the mean field theory, that is, in the theory I described in the first view graph, goes with some number times D m squared average, where m squared average is the positive number, depending on dimensionality. And B, this is the variance of the fluctuation of the finite temperature, is positive definite, this is positive, and so this will actually cause the thing to cross zero and you get first order and high temperature. And that is what produces that phase diagram I showed you before, which I'll plot again here. So as you go up in temperature, eventually you will cross zero and we get a second order phase transition. This point here is a place where B in fact is zero and A is zero, the coefficient of the second order transition.
So if I take that model, I'm sorry.
Yeah, go ahead.
But if I took that model and I would apply the atomic field, then I would naively expect to suppress M square average, right? With a field that would suppress the fluctuations which cause the fluctuation-induced second
order. Oh, that can happen, yeah. Of course.
The curve you're drawing actually goes the other way. I'm just trying to bring it.
Okay, let me plot this as actually the function of M squared. And that involves a zero point part plus the thermal part. Of course, this term here could be big enough to give you a positive value of B at zero temperature. And so this could be this term here alone. It changes the sign. That would be a fluctuation driven at zero temperature, second order efficiency. So you could still get a second order efficiency.
But I still would expect a different tendency with field, right?
A different?
With magnetic field. Wouldn't I suppress M square?
Yes, yes. The magnetic field is very complicated in that model.
Okay.
Absolutely. But yes, it is possible this way to get a second, you still get a second order. I'm not saying that it's impossible, right, at all. It's just that we haven't seen it yet. And there may be cases where the zero order term will be strong enough. But
can I ask a quick one? Can you go back to this curve when I have many different GCs? Ferromagnet, anti-ferromagnet, Ising case.
Oh, yeah.
This one.
Yeah.
Oh, two quick comments. First, the skinning argument that you gave about magnetic impurities close to phase transition is basically curving of your ferromagnetic line at very, very small Ka. If you...
You may actually be completely wiped out. At this end, you're going to be wiped out by impurity in many cases?
No, I'm saying that in different. There are two points here. First, the difference between ferromagnet and anti-ferromagnet, between red and blue here, is because you, in some sense, because you try to normalize temperature by the same parameter.
Yes, it's all completely,
It depends how you define this parameter. You may well have ferromagnetic temperature well above anti-ferromagnetic temperature.
Okay, when I make this comparison, I have to be careful to say that all else being equal, I must be sure that no other parameters are being changed, and you may have circumstances.
But dumping is different in two cases.
Yeah. I appreciate, and in fact, the more we think about this problem, the more we love just about anything can happen. And it's difficult to make predictions, really.
And second point that I want to make is that the effect that you name, namely that close to ferromagnetic transition, fluctuations and has magnetic impurities, basically is only relevant at very small Ka when you see this curving down of
that's
the
true,
ferromagnetic.
Yeah. This in fact, that's right. So this effect here can be interpreted that way. Mm-hmm. The point is that you have pair forming and pair breaking tendencies. So in you have the pair forming effect, and then of course there's a self-energy term, which may actually be pair breaking. And this balance here, in that balance, the pair forming tends to dominate in the D-wave channel, but the pair breaking eventually tends to dominate in the D-wave channel. However, I say that none of this should be believed down here, because really the correction to the single exchange is becoming larger and larger and divergent and important. And the nature of the phase diagram down here could be really very different from what I've shown. But here's basically a guideline, which we know we're tentative, and it's open, definitely going to be revised as time goes on. But they're useful in giving us some ideas about where to look and what materials to investigate. But I think one of the long-standing puzzles that I wanted to address is the fact that we just don't find examples of supertransitivity on the border of ferromagnets. And is this a fundamental problem for the theory, or is it in fact that we weren't thinking carefully enough about the theory? And I think the answer for the moment is the second, that one was not thinking about the real structure of the Reinhardt function, taking appropriate forms for it. Now you can see how these are pair-breaking effects by using this diagram, and I think the point was really first made by Hunter, Kamp, and Rice, and in a somewhat different model from, well, very different model from what I discussed here, but with similar conclusions. Here's the Fermi surface of interest, and in the P-wave state with the energy gap changes sign across the equator, and we see that these transitions, these oncoli processes that are connected with those peaks, that small cubes, are taking an electron from a state of one sign to a state of another sign in the energy gap. And this is third breaking in the three-way channel. And it's difficult, in fact, to get supercommutivity in this model. We have to hope that these kinds of transitions here can carry today, or that something else is going on. The message is that it is difficult to find. There are reasons, and good reasons, within the model itself why it has been difficult to find the examples of ferromagnetic superconductors. And the analogy with helium-3 was mistaken, essentially because it ignored these uncollected processes which don't exist in helium-3. But the spin-degeneracy factor was there, of course, and explained why you get 1 million Kelvin with a Fermi temperature of order 1 Kelvin in the case of helium-3. However, well, we can do one thing. We can say, well, let's try to eliminate the transverse spin fluctuations, which are, we know for sure, are pair-breaking. And one way to do this is to go to highly anisotropic materials. And then this brought us basically this and other reasons. Led us to select this material for closer investigation. Uranium-germanium-2 was known to be an itinerant electron ferromagnet in the sense that one could understand the magnetic properties, the magnetization, using Fermi surfaces, as in the case of iron, nickel, and cobalt. However, it differed from iron, nickel, and cobalt in having a huge magnetic anisotropy field of order 100 tesla along the A-axis in this direction. And this more or less quenches the transverse fluctuation, giving us longitudinal fluctuation. And when you look at a system like this, again, magnified scale here, so this is all in the millikelvin range, one does find a superconducting dome, but it's not really what we had originally expected. And so let me explain what goes on here. First of all, as we go across from high pressure, go across in this direction, you see, first of all, a very large first order transition here. In other words, this is, we have found in many other cases, the ferromagnetic critical point is first order. There is a tri-critical point around this region here, and then it becomes second order with higher temperature. So in agreement with this phase diagram that you see here. In fact, the data for this behavior, for the magnetization, for the theory temperature, and its field dependence is very similar to this. As you go further into the ferromagnetic state, there is an additional ferromagnetic transition, but it's called a metamagnetic transition because it's non-symmetry breaking and the magnetization just simply jumps to a higher value. And it's weaker, it's more nearly second order, and it has a critical line here, which is a critical endpoint around 10 Kelvin. In some sense, this is quite analogous to the problem of serine copper to silicon too, where we had a density transition, but in this case it's a magnetic ferromagnetic transition, where we have both density and longitudinal magnetization fluctuations that play a role. In the ferromagnetic state, it's not possible to separate out the magnetic fluctuations from the density fluctuations that come together. And it is around this region here where we have very large amplitude longitudinal spin fluctuations that show up in the t-squared coefficient of relativity, the linear coefficient of not have the heat capacity, and in the parallel susceptibility itself, that you actually see evidence of superconductivity. In this case, as in previous cases, one sees a heat capacity anomaly suggesting that the transition is a bulk phenomena. And NMR data, recent NMR data from Kitaoka's group, suggests that the superconductivity and the ferromagnetism coexist in the same region, the same domain, and that the superconductivity is described by lines of nodes. Let me just say that there are now three such examples of itinerant electron ferromagnets, starting with UG2, and uranium, rhodium, germanium, and now more recently discovered in Japan, uranium, iridium. They all have very strong uniaxial anisotropy. For a while, we thought that zirconium Z2 was superconducting. It is superconducting, but it appears to be a surface effect and of unknown origin. And it was a bit of a puzzle because zirconium Z2 does not have uniaxial anisotropy.
Are you all having this tricritical point?
Yes. They all have, these are inescapable. In some cases, they were hard to find, but eventually you can find them below 1,000 in some cases.
So it seems to be interesting to just empirically to say whether all the heavy fermion superconductors are sitting near the transition, or some are actually deep in the phases. Now, there's been statement that uranium, palladium to aluminum 3 is an exception in the sense that it's actually deep inside the ordered state. Is it?
It is in the early phase, but they're large amp, so they get quite strong spin fluctuations there as well. Which are,
transverse fluctuations.
Which are, the crystal field type excitation and so on, which have been studied by neutron scattering, appear to be capable of explaining the superconductivity. So it all has to do with whether these magnetic density fluctuations are sufficiently large in amplitude. Of course, superconductivity can be inside the ordered phase. But I think you'll find that if you're deeply inside the ordered phase, with very, very high transition temperature, very large moment, it may be difficult to get superconductivity unless it's due to some other totally different mechanism, bonons, for example.
You missed the plutonium compound. You missed the plutonium, gallium, indium compound.
Of course. I was very careful. You see,
okay.
Border, I should have said, four atoms and five. Plutonium should be in there, yes. And that is a very interesting case, because what happened there is they increased the energy scale of the spin fluctuation by a factor of 5 or so, and 10, and TC went up by more or less the same factor. Which is incidentally not inconsistent with the picture that I we presented here, because we're scaling TC with this spin fluctuation scale. So if we go from an F metal to a B metal, we expect TC to go up by a factor of 100, 50, 100. So the same, otherwise everything else kept the same.
Since you've mentioned that situation, does this kind of model predict a Curie susceptibility in the normal state?
The model that I started with, this so-called itinerant electron model, it was one of the great successes of the model, and was one of the reasons why initially it was taken seriously, because it could account for the linear inverse susceptibility, which is rather a mystery in metals. Mm-hmm. It comes right here. If we go back to the simpler case of the Gibbs-Orlando-Wilson form, where this thing changes with temperature by an amount which depends on V m squared average. And that this quantity here actually goes as linear, very close to linear at high temperature, and gave you a linear susceptibility. It has a very different interpretation from the usual Curie Weibull. That was the big problem, you see, the center case. It couldn't explain the Curie by susceptibility.
Yes.
Because it always gave T squared type susceptibility.
Yes.
And it was this that changed the story at that point. It made people think maybe there was something to this type of thing.
You mentioned these uranium-based ferromagnets. Since they are 5F, is there any indication that at higher temperatures, anything related to quantum physics is
The systems I mentioned are not usually considered to be in that class. They're much more like the D metal, these materials here. These materials here are quite often thought of as being like D metal. The F bands are relatively broad. And so if you ask whether the resistivity exhibits a maximum and a downturn, I believe not in these materials.
These materials being those last three.
I just mean these systems here. All right, I'd like to also briefly mention that, and this may be a problem for the model that I've been describing, is that despite a search for a number of years, there still isn't an example of a heavy fermion superconductor, as far as I'm aware, unless something has been discovered in the last few months. And this is a bit surprising. At first sight, these materials, what matters in the model is whether or not you're close to the border of magnetism. However, it's recently confirmed that in this material, one finds that proximity not only to anti-ferromagnetism, but also to ferromagnetism. This is devastating for the term formations of the type I described. As Philippe Montu and McHale have shown, if you take a system on the border of tormentism and add in some anti-comedic simplicity, you quickly suppress D-wave pairing. Likewise, if you take a system on the border of anti-comedicism with D-wave pairing and add in terminating fluctuation, you very rapidly suppress the supersensitivity. So maybe it's not surprising that these systems and any other system that's close to being ordered locally that have local magnitude will not show the type of supersensitivity. We need non-locality in space. This is crucial to the story. Now we want to come back to this figure just to go back to this question which was raised a moment ago, is what happens in this region here? And I want to look at that a bit more closely. So this is a schematic view of what actually happened in a number of materials, not just UG2. And what is being ignored here, dropped, is the superconducting dome and the second metamagnetic transition, not going to be discussed here. As I mentioned earlier, that the puzzle seems to be that the model of this type predicts a T-squared to T-squared transition here with hardly any change in the exponent of the resistivity. But in fact, one observes in a couple of cases is a transition from T-squared to T-squared we have. So the best example is still MNFI, but I'll list a number of new examples of this phenomenon. And what we see here is the terminated transition temperature plotted versus pressure for a spiral state. In fact, it's a long way from spiral, so like an incommensurate ferromagnet. And the exponent is determined, as shown here, by plotting the logarithmic derivative of the resistivity. This is an example of very low residual resistivity measurements made by Chris Weider. And this case with four orders of magnitude in temperature. And below a few Kelvin, one finds the exponent is quadratic on this side, on the terminating side, and then abruptly, and quite abruptly, changes to T to 3/2 on the terminating side. Now, what would the same model that I discussed earlier for nickel germanium, what would it predict in this case? We have all the neutron parameters and so on. Nothing, 2 all the way across, no change. But this is a discrepancy to the model, and it cannot be easily rescued without some, I think, significant changes in the theory. And maybe I should also stress that this has been studied not only as a function of pressure, but also as a function of magnetic field by Laurent Leroux, who found a similar effect that when you apply a field and go into the metamagnetic transition, the exponent goes from 3/2 or suddenly to 2. So there's a plateau, a whole region here in red, where one sees essentially a T to the 3/2 temperature dependence. And we have not yet, we expect, of course, a very high pressure to recover a T squared form, but we have not yet found the high enough pressure to see this.
Do you think that point in higher pressure will be a quantum phase transition?
I don't know. Because I don't understand this state at all. I have no prediction for it. Now, there's a list of materials where I don't want to give the impression that T to the 3/2 is rarely observed. In fact, it's very frequently observed. It's just that in that particular case of MNFI, we don't have an explanation in terms of the model that I just called the attenuant electron model. And I just listed here a number of cases, including in the stoichiometric compound, the ferromagnetic metal, not only MNFI, but also cobalt disulfide shows this effect. Nickel, free aluminum, zirconium, they do have first sort of transition, that is a critical, quantum critical, tricritical point. Uranium, cobalt, aluminum, uranium, germanium, two, and uranium, iridium, all have tricritical points, in some cases two. There's a nested transition inside the outer transition. Also, one sees T to 3/2 form in a number of antiferromagnetic metals, and metals on the border of mod insulating state.
So all of these have a finite region, T to the 3/2?
Yeah, in some cases those are a wide region. I'll give an example in a moment. There's quite a wide region temperature.
And again, it is what you measure down to the lowest temperatures. There's nothing happening even lower, which becomes more benign.
Well,
as far as you know.
Well, it turns out that indeed in B metals below 1 Kelvin, you are strongly affected by this order because the resistivity is starting to saturate, the temperature is starting to saturate, to become very small. And so below 1 Kelvin, delta rho, the temperature dependent part, can be sizable compared to rho zero. And then you find some sample dependencies. And so I haven't really focused on that part. We measure up to 10 samples before we think we have a sort of test that. That is robust.
Thank you. Which of the ferromagnetic ones are actually having spiral orders?
Oh, this is a good question. See, actually, that is, I don't think it's been carefully studied, but I can say this, that we rarely see a high, I've always been puzzled by the fact that there's a susceptibility, the AC susceptibility or the DC susceptibility, measured as you approach the so-called ferromagnetic transition, are rarely very high. That is to say, in units, in the, say, CGS units, like 10 to minus 2, well, you might expect quite large numbers. For example, in a ferroelectric transition, 50,000. But we're measuring in the same lab, in one place, the so-called ferromagnetic transition, the 10 to minus 2 susceptibility, and right across the ferroelectric, the 10 to the 5. And it makes you wonder whether we're actually looking at ferromagnetic transition. And it may be that the reason is that we're actually seeing there are spiral transitions. Very small Q, and maybe confused for domain in some cases. I don't think it's really looked at very carefully. But I can say this, that there was recently a paper on gadolinium where it was shown that, well, it was long thought to be a ferromagnet, but actually a spiral.
You say even at the finite temperature transitions, which is second order, the universe said they never get that big.
Well, this is all speculative, because no one has really looked by neutron scattering to see carefully whether there are spirals or not. But I'm just raising a suspicion that there may actually be spirals in some cases where we think they have ferromagnetism. And there's some reason for suspecting this could be the case on the basis of the theoretical model I showed you before.
In all of them. In all of them, possibly.
But there are always going to be exceptions, but more than we originally thought.
But zirconia zinc too is established to be purely ferromagnetic, or even that is seen now. Zirconia zinc too, I thought.
That is the first order phase transition.
That's a Q=0 order, is it not?
That is, I don't think it's been established by very careful measurement of these Q=0.
If the religion is involved, everything is.
You see, very small Q, very difficult to distinguish, and there's a tendency to just gloss over the problems. But I know that we don't get very high susceptibilities, and it's still a question of understanding why that should be the case.
And how small does Q have to become before it's difficult to resolve in neutrons?
I think there are neutrons. I mean, it's a question really of wanting to do the experiment. It is possible to do these experiments, but it's very time consuming, and it's low Q, you have to get rid of backgrounds, and It can be costly and complicated. You have to really believe. This was done apparently in gadolinium because people were suspicious and they found in fact gadolinium orders in the spiral state and not in the ferromagnetic state. We started with the idea of the second order phase transition, and now we know that in most all the cases that we've studied the first order. We started with the idea that they were ferromagnetic, and maybe we'll find that really they're not. And the spiral state. And this is what I find so fascinating about
they're all
looking at the real world. I don't want to say all. There's a tendency to generalize, it's just dangerous. But there are many other cases where one sees the powers in this range. And I give the range because there is sometimes a sample dependence, the range, temperature range of the experiment, accuracy in the experiment. But they're all in that range, 1.5 to 1.7. And intriguingly, a couple of elemental metals, show T to the 3 halves resistivity, or in this case close to 5/3 at the upper end of this range. But these are materials that are both on the order of magnetism and structural phase transition, which is very complicated material. So very interesting. Well, I've given you just a list of materials, but I wanted to just give you one more example of the T to the 3 halves behavior. This is a different material, nickel sulfur selenium system, which is in some sense the antichromatic counterpart of nickel selenium in the B metal with a cubic structure with a much suppressed transition temperature compared to pure nickel. And at the stoichiometric composition, x equal 1, so we have nickel, sulfur, and selenium, the system finds itself just at the edge here of the antichromatic transition to a metallic antichromatic state. And at that point, this group, me and Saka and co-workers, had found a T to the 3 half variation which extends actually up to about 100 Kelvin, the white range. And we thought perhaps this was a peculiarly property of a disordered case when sulfur and selenium are randomly substituted. So Philippe Nicolas studied nickel disulfide, the pure material, which shows very similar phase diagram with pressure. And at the critical pressure, which is about 75 kilobars, he finds more or less the same kind of behavior with a roughly T to the 3 half. So this is T to the 3 half, not we cannot describe or explain this some disorder that may be present in the system. Now, I don't want to suggest that these T to 3 half exponents are not explainable in any of those cases. I'm merely saying that in the few cases of ferromagnetic metal on the border of first order transition, it is difficult to understand this exponent. And this new graph is going to be very much out of date.
In some sense, one has to differentiate between the exponent being somewhere that's 3/2 or 4/3 or whatever fractional number,
yeah,
versus whether there's a range of parameters over which such a parallel is happening.
In other words, range of pressure and magnetic field, for example.
For instance.
For example, yeah. This is, I think, the MSI is the case that's most extensively studied in that way. In the other cases, it's not quite true. I mean, there are several other examples of the same kind where a study has been done over a wide range of pressures, cobalt disulfide, where you see T squared in the ferromagnetic state at low pressure going over to a power around 1.6. over a range of pressures until you get to about 100 kilobars, and then it goes back up to 2. So there we have been able to go from 2 to a low power back to 2, where the simple theory predicted just 2 all the way up. And that may be helpful in clarifying what's going on.
But just another point that's related. I mean, in principle, even Alshar-Aronoff gives T to the 3 half.
What?
The Alshar-Aronoff, this disorder,
yes.
Description.
Here at 3 hands, I've been seen in St. Glasses, for example.
Yeah, the conduct you might see,
no,
I think
it's due to. Yeah, well, St. Glasses.
When it's false. Direction, it doesn't matter.
Yeah,
right.
It's correction.
But the point, we cannot necessarily rule out disorder. However, I can say that in MSI, the exponent was studied as a function of rho zero.
But some of the alloy ones.
Oh yeah, that's why I just wanted to point out there are many examples. I'm not saying that they're all explaining the same theory, or that they're related to the MSI problem, but that you need to know that there are other cases where exponents like this are seen. And I should say that in this case, the effect of disorder was studied by varying the rho zero by the factor of 20, and there was no change in the T squared coefficient or the power law. T to 3 half any coefficient for the power law. But even that does not necessarily rule out the role of disorder. There may be some peculiar cancellation effect that allow the coefficient to be independent of rho zero, up to a wide range, over a wide range of rho zero. So in fact, this brings me to the point I really wanted to make, is that there are many proposals in recent times to go well beyond what we call the attenuance electron model. And I've only given a few examples, and at the end of this meeting, I know I'll be able to expand on this list quite a bit. I know there's a lot of recent work by Shubikov, which is not actually mentioned here. But I bring it up mainly to discuss, to mention the last one here, which maybe you cannot see, that basically describes this possible effect of magnetic heterogeneity. So, on the border of the first order phase transition, it may be natural to suppose that the system is actually magnetically heterogeneous, even if it if the system is nominally pure. In other words, it's not necessarily the disorder which is coming from frozen-in disorder, but maybe self-organizing in some sense, maybe intrinsic disorder, of island of magnetism. Some people talk about instantons. And that the physics, therefore, on the border of these first versions, which may be very different from that which has been considered so far. For example, in this type of theory, one has now a negative B, positive B, and in nonchalantly one treats this in knee field theory. But actually, a negative B would imply that the state fluctuations are actually attracted, have an attractive interaction. So these overdamped bosons, or let's say the bosonic degrees of freedom, have an attractive interaction. And it's not clear that under those circumstances we can correctly treat this using the field approximation. Moreover, the free energy that you get from this has a multi-beacon minimum structure, and one can imagine transitions which are very slow between the minimum and the first order transition phase diagrams. Between the minima, and these would be, and are sometimes called instantons, these could lead to a completely different picture for the normal state. And that is something which has been discussed, but as the details of the predictions of the effect of the consequences of the magnetic heterogeneity, I don't think have been worked out in detail for the pure material. So this final view graph summarizes the various effects that have been observed on the border of the thermogenetic phase transitions, quantum phase transitions, and what I have not discussed is the case of the spin triplet superconductivity instruction ruthenate. Interestingly, if we were to put this in this phase diagram, we would have to be located quite far from this first order transition region, deep into a thermoliquid state. The bilayer ruthenate, on the other hand, is very close to this tricritical point, and interestingly, is not superconducting. That means that we might imagine that the superconducting phase diagram for the case of the ruthenate may have a vanishing region here going to a maximum at high pressure or corresponding parameter which is being used to tune this acid. So that maybe speculate as to the form of the phase diagram at this point. As a function of pressure in a material like calcium ruthenate, which starts out at low pressures as ferromagnetic, and there may then be a first order ferromagnetic transition followed by possibly a transition to the spin triplet phase, T-wave phase. And so it suggests that there's something very wrong with the magnetic interaction model, because it predicts, of course, that the maximum of this curve will be quite close to the thermogenetic boundary. That is one of the... of course, this measure, these experiments have not yet been done. They're in progress at the moment. These pressures are a couple of hundred kilobars per calcium ruthenate. And Patricia Lee-Luriza has reached this point here, has actually found that the thermogenetic transition goes first order and drops off very rapidly in that case. And this, of course, is a question mark. This measurement has not yet been made. But that would suggest that there is some analogy to the copper oxide in that the superconductivity disappears as you get close to the, in that case, of the antithermogenetic boundaries, and that this disappearance of superconductivity is not, in fact, consistent with the prediction of the model I discussed today, and nor is, of course, the theta that we have with activity in MNSI.
Question.
Yeah.
Is it isentropic system?
This is the... Yes.
Then why is it inconsistent? Why it's not inconsistent?
Oh, well, it's inconsistent with the model that I described. Because
I think it's consistent with the model you described.
No, let me show you. Well, I think I know what you're going to say, but I'll show you that it doesn't work. At first sight, it would seem that we expect in this model for TC actually to drop off as you approach the magnetic boundary. But if you actually put in the numbers, this corresponds to be essentially right at the border here. Moreover, remember that this is a first order transition. So actually, we're actually starting off here. The kappa is not zero. We have a major contradiction. And for reasons that are not easy to understand within this model, it's just a continuity that's appearing in the solution here. And actually, this is the main point I wanted to make today. There are other points. I just indicate various people that have contributed to this work, and I'll leave that up at the end. The more complete list of references.
Great. Thank you. A question to you. Can you show us a bit about your new rig?
Oh. Okay, so, well, this poses the question as to what is going on in the phase diagram corresponding to the terminated transition in two dimensions. And that requires high pressures. And so there is one more thing to be said before I show you that there is also a prediction for the form of the phase diagram in a material like strontium ruthenate if one could change the filling of the band. So close to the filling where we are, the filling level actually present, which means that we're close to the Van Hove singularity, one expects the T wave, supersymmetric state, at very low TC. But if the filling gets closer to half filling, one expects antichromatic fluctuations, and the model that I discussed earlier predicts V wave pairing with much, much higher TC. And it would be interesting to study, therefore, different type of oxide material, not only the Fluke wave, and to reach the conditions required to basically to test this prediction. And this requires very high pressures, which are about an order of magnitude to two orders of magnitude higher than in the heavy fermion system. And it requires the use of diamond anvil technology. And this is a development taking place in several laboratories around the world to essentially embed wires inside of the diamond anvil. So one grows electrical wires onto the diamond, and then by chemical vapor deposition, grow a layer of diamond on top of the wire, the leaves themselves. So the difficulty is in actually having leaves go into the high pressure regime. With this type of design, one can introduce hydrostatic pressure and make contact in a more systematic manner. But that requires using microtechnology, sort of to prepare samples in tens of micron size and to bond these samples onto these four wires in a region which may be 30 microns in size. But with this kind of technology, it should be possible to more or less routinely get up to even a megabar in pressure. And that opens up a big field of all the transition metals with high critical pressure for transitions to magnetic and superconducting state. On top of this, we've been working on simplifying the technology for getting to low temperatures. And this is the first system we built, which is not marketed by Cambridge magnetic refrigerators. It's basically a very simple millikelvin refrigerator based on magnetic cooling. And the next generation system, this is the system we've been using for all of our experiments since we've been discussing today. But the next step is a rather more ambitious one, which we think is now timely. It's to develop a refrigerator which can vary the temperature from 1 mK to room temperature continuously in one experiment. So you have an enormous temperature range for exploration in a routine manner. And this is based on the following idea, that we have a magnet system with a room temperature bore, which is cooled by a pulse to cryocooler, it's probably no liquid helium, essentially, no external source of helium, and an insert fridge with another cryocooler, which can be inserted into this magnet system. So this system stays cold essentially all the time, and this can be cycled very rapidly over short periods of time, allowing access to the sample region in matters of minutes, one can change samples once it's been extracted, and we think it can be cycled from one Lilly column to room temperature on a fairly regular basis, maybe once a day or every 2 days. That is being built at the moment and involves two magnetic stages, which have been developed in collaboration with Cambridge Magnetic Configuration. What this does is it means that it makes it more or less routine to explore some of the problems I discussed. It does not require advanced training in the use of cryogenic systems. I believe this can be done by even an undergraduate student could operate this kind of system. It's fully automated.
Well, let's not go too far. How much
it can be set up. Well, this is a development project, so it's quite expensive, but I think eventually it can come down to 100,000.
Target is
$100,000. Maybe $200,000.
$200,000.
Yeah. A development project is costing about 50% more than that. But it's the ease of use, and it's basically incorporating all, and basically we have a list of all the things that have gone wrong over 25 years of low temperature physics, very extensive list. And we said, okay, let's get rid of all those things, they can never happen again. And we tried, it is designed to do that. Many of the experiments that I've done could be done much more quickly than anything done at the moment because of the difficulty of cryogenic research.
What's your cooling power at 50 millikelvin?
Oh, okay. Well, for this system, well, I can tell you, this system here we use all the time. We cool, this is the sample stage, and we're cooling pressure cells to 50 millikelvin, which are this size. Because we wouldn't want to put those pressure cells in the dilution refrigerator because of the stresses on the system and so on. But we have a working space in here for 5 kilogram pressure cells, which are cooled to about 50 millikelvin. So the cooling power, I have a figure only for 100 millikelvin, which is about 50 microwatts at 100 millikelvin. With the kind of experiments we do, we can stay cold for 2 days at base temperature. It's not as high as as you can achieve with the dilution refrigerator, but it's not an order of magnitude lower either.
Oh, 50 microwatts is wonderful.
It's reasonable, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And of course, this could be increased. I mean, this depends on the dimension of this system here. I mean, we don't need a lot of cooling power, but it could be increased quite a bit. Oh, can I just follow up on your point? You see, there is something that is making magnetic cooling have a new lease on life, besides just improvements in the traditional methods, and that is that has something to do with this subject that we're discussing today, quantum criticality. Because if we have some doping parameter here, the standard method of making a coolant is to reduce the density, by inserting water into, say, CPA or FAA and so on, to separate the spin, so one can get a Curie law susceptibility down to low temperature. And this means that we get a rather large magnetic field which is non-conducting or poorly conducting. And now, we can also go the other way. Instead of diluting the spins, we can increase the spin density and go down close to the quantum critical point. And this way, we achieve high density of spins and also high thermal conductivity because we become metal at that point. And that, in fact, our first stage in one of our cells involves already this principle. It's a much smaller scale. Actually, in that case, there is a frustration, a lattice frustration effect in gadolinium gallium garnet, which gives you high spin density, but it's not so much the Pauli principle that frustrates the spins in that case, but it's the lattice frustration. But the principle is the same. But we have a number of candidate materials, so we're really trying to make money out of the fun of things.
Okay, thank you.